This hearing will be resumed. Thank you for your patience. It's my pleasure to yield 5 minutes to the distinguished ranking member from Pennsylvania, Mr. Dent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the panel for sticking around here. Apologize for the interruption. Mr. Salmon, thanks, too, for your being here today and also for your work on this issue and also for your meeting with me separately from this meeting. One thing I noticed, and I recognize that the that a notice of proposed rulemaking, when I noticed that, it's a proposal. Why do you think that, in hindsight, well, why do you think that TSA, why did TSA issue such a broad sweeping rule that, in the opinion of many, was pretty far off the mark with respect to the LSAP program?
I think the approach there was just it's easier to bring something back down once you get the comments rather than trying to broaden if you find out you've missed the mark somewhere. So it was probably more broadly based. And I think where we're going, as we've discussed, is much more narrowly focused based upon considerable industry input.
Thank you. And did TSA, did you guys consult with any stakeholders prior to the release of the original NPRM?
Yes. In fact, Administrator Hawley, on numerous occasions, had meetings with stakeholders and attempted to come to some process, but he met personally, as I did, and other staff met with stakeholders beforehand.
And how does TSA document any consultations with outside groups, or industry groups, or stakeholders while developing a potential rule?
The documentation of those meetings, I would have to check and get back to you and let you know. On the working sessions, we have documented them, and I think they're being cleared to be put on a public format.
Okay. And also, and finally, in your written testimony, you mentioned the automatic detention and processing terminal, or ADAPT,
yes,
as a system designed to mitigate the use of a GA aircraft as a conveyance to transport dangerous persons and materials in the country. How does that work, and how does it distinguish between scheduled legitimate flight and a flight that may be deviating from its flight path?
Yes. ADAPT is a program developed by FAA. They track tail numbers, and essentially ADAPT is just a, if you think about it, as a data management system. So with that tail number, for instance, if the particular aircraft is part of a security plan, ADAPT recognizes that. If people who do not have security plans and are applying to come to the country, for instance, apply for waivers, if they have a waiver, ADAPT will recognize that. If they don't, ADAPT will recognize the aircraft, highlight it to FAA, and ground stop that aircraft. We've had a considerable number of aircraft, say, from Venezuela, who come up without waivers, ground stop in Fort Lauderdale stopped. But it essentially, what kind of information that you want to tag onto that particular tail number, ADAPT is simply, that's what it does.
Thank you. And Dr. Galloway, thank you, too, for being here as well. I've been out to the DNDO facilities out there in Nevada and have had some interesting, I got quite an education out there. And as you, you know, you're responsible for developing, DNDO is responsible for developing of a global nuclear detection architecture predicated on the understanding that, and I quote, no single layer of defense can detect all radiological and nuclear threats. How does the radiation nuclear detection on general aviation aircraft play in DNDO's global nuclear detection architecture?
We look at all the pathways coming into the United States in the border layer. We look at the maritime coming across land and also air. So we looked at the entire aviation pathway and found a variety of, obviously a variety of flights that come into the country. And so we're trying to work across the board. Our analysis, however, shows that international general aviation is particularly attractive because it allows somebody a lot of autonomy. They can maintain control of the weapon because they could travel with it if they chose. The speed obviously is attractive, but then finally that they could fly it, in fact, directly to the target without ever encountering officials here in the United States.
And my next question is this, and I understand that concern. Do you agree with the TSA and the Inspector General's conclusion that that general aviation provides a possible method for terrorist attack, but certainly nothing indicates it's a probable method for an attack? Do you agree with that contention?
We have no specific intelligence information that suggests that this is a threat vector that the adversary is pursuing.
And how is DNDO working with TSA and CBP to address this high consequence but low probability method of attack?
We would work with both those agencies, but CBP would probably be the more natural one that we would have overseas pre-clearance airports where we would go out and do radiation scanning of the aircraft to assure that there's not a nuclear device on board the aircraft before it departs foreign soil. And then we would have confidence that it, as it enters U.S. airspace, that it's okay.
And I'm sorry. Mr. Salmon, one other series of little questions here. In your testimony, you mentioned that a critical aspect of TSA's regulatory approach is the process-oriented nature of devising mandatory security measures. By process-oriented nature, are you referring to the rulemaking process?
I'm sorry, the process-oriented nature?
Yeah. Are you referring to the rulemaking process?
Yes.
Okay. And if so, then why does the TSA have literally dozens of security directives issued without any opportunity for public notice or comment?
I think there were two security directives which were issued recently, one called 8F, another 8G. The regulated parties in both cases, the directly regulated parties, were the airports. The 8F was designed specifically to address vulnerabilities for people with unescorted access in commercial airports. They do not apply to general aviation airports. So we consulted specifically with both AAAE and ACI, the two major airport associations, who also brought airports in to comment on both on the security directive. As we got closer to the deadlines, we also consulted with other affected stakeholders. But you must also be aware that the other people who were affected by this would be Coca-Cola vendors, plant maintainers, anybody who's wandering around airports who does not, with unescorted access, who has not been issued an airport cleared security badge. So there's a wide variety of folks, but we most of our consultation was with the regulated party, the airports.
And finally, what's the process for issuing these security directives, and are they ever reviewed to identify if an actual rulemaking would be possible?
In the case when the security directive, particularly the 8F, was issued because of security vulnerabilities that were identified by ICE and other parties at O'Hare, where parties were using unauthorized badges. Illegal people were basically taking badges out of a box, using those as their airport credentials, and we wanted to move forward as expeditiously as possible to close that vulnerability. Rulemaking would have taken us much longer.
Thank you. Thank you for indulgence. I yield back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dent. And before I move to the next panel, I have just a few questions that I wanted to make sure that we were clear and that I had a full understanding. Salmon, as we go forward in the rulemaking process, I'm going to ask you and your team, and I know that your team is being rebuilt as it moves forward under this new administration, to keep this committee, this chairwoman, and the full committee apprised of the progress of the rulemaking. In fact, as chairwoman of this subcommittee, I would like to have, along with the staff, specific briefings as you make your way through this process. The other question is, as you watched the video, and I do agree with much of the comments that have been made by my colleagues, particularly Mr. Lundgren, I think, made some points about farmers and the question of a manifest and some of the challenges in general aviation when you ask for the preciseness of a manifest and the time frame. I might add that I also recognize that general aviation has much different topography when we talk about where small planes may land. Coming from Texas, they may land on an airstrip on a farm. But my question to you is, in the view that you have just been able to look at, we do have a reasonable need to be concerned about perimeter invasion or entry. Let me not use the term invasion as much as perimeter entry. Will you look at that in your rulemaking, particularly as it relates, as we discussed previously, Teterboro, I believe, in New Jersey, in a congested area, and the airports in Houston, because there was a clear, if you will, violation of the perimeter. An un-ID'd, uninvited, non-relevant, meaning that the person had no purpose, and I won't even call them a visitor, got on the grounds with no bar or no security check whatsoever. So that is a problem, is it not? Yeah, if you could turn your mic on so I could hear you. I think you have. That is a problem, is it not?
Yes. And in 2004, we issued a series of security guidelines.
Right. I understand that.
And the guidelines, for instance, at airports, as you were speaking of, would include fencing, hangar security, CCTV, intrusion detection, access controls, lighting, personal ID, and so on and so forth. Our struggle there has been to issue those as a mandate without a funding source, and that's been the thing we've been struggling with, is in terms of, we are the assessment of vulnerabilities, the riskiness of the airport, the grass strip, for instance, compared to a Teterboro, and the requirements are clearly laid out, but the question is, if we issue a rule, how will it be paid for? And we don't know that yet. That's our struggle.
Well, we've established that there is a threat. We established that there's a vulnerability. And I think we established on this record that 9/11 was not predicted, per se. I assume there were many security experts that probably have written or wrote articles pre-9/11 saying America is vulnerable. But it had not reached the American psyche, or unfortunately, the policymakers, many of whom are here today, including myself, if you will, on this whole question of terrorism. So we now have a different look at terrorism. We know that we may not all be able to predict what might happen, and even though we have not had a terrorist act on our soil, which we are very grateful for, the combination of the executive and Congress working together to ensure that not happen, we cannot predict the future. So my point to you would be that we want to work with you. There needs to be a balance in the struggle that you have, and frankly, I believe there can be a balance. Teterboro, there can be established parameters and regulations that would be very helpful. And I believe in Houston there can be a balance of the smaller airports, but as you noted in the video, large airplanes seemingly were housed there. So I want to pose the question, and I'd like to work on a response with you, that we look at perimeter security as it relates to risk-based analysis, small and large, but also as it relates to just the penetration and vulnerability aspects of it, because you can have a small airport with large aircraft that is, in essence, housed there. Can we work on this issue, and do you see the necessity of ensuring perimeter security?
I would be happy to come up and sit down with staff and with you to discuss this and discuss the procedures and that are in place, and then discuss how we would go forward, particularly if it were made part of a rule and without the funding. I think that's really the issue, and
I understand.
Spend as much time as possible.
And you see the need for perimeter security?
It's in part of our guidelines. We just have no means. It's just a resource to make it happen.
Mr. Mann, let me just raise this one question with you, and I would appreciate it if you convey this to the IG, Mr. Skinner. I do believe that you worked in good faith, but I do believe you did a disservice in the summary and the conclusions that came about. I assume you responded to what was an interesting and provocative headline as to whether or not Houston was a sitting duck. I don't believe the answer needed to be as provocative. No, it is not a sitting duck. Do you have any scientific evidence that if a small plane was either loaded or non-loaded and penetrated one of our refineries, one of the tanks in our refineries, one of the areas that are holding chemicals, that there would not be a potential catastrophic event?
Well, there's certainly the potential for that.
But let me have you answer the question. A small plane could cause damage and a catastrophic event, could it not?
It could.
It could. So even if you want to hang your hat on the question of risk and whether it ever happened, Again, I emphasize to you that I am not trying to, in essence, cry fire in a crowded theater. I'm not trying to re-elevate the horror of 9/11. We all went through that, and those in New York most of all. But I am trying to capture the unpredictability of terrorism. And therefore, the concern I have with the IG's report is that you gave no credence to the unpredictability of terrorism, and you gave no credence to the particular area that you're in. You've just heard me say that I supported Ms. Norton. I am not against general aviation. I frankly believe it should be open here in this region, and we should find ways to secure it. But then in Houston, it's just laissez-faire. It's okay. And you seem to not look at the region that we are in. Those airports were minutes away from our refinery corridor with all kinds of potential. We've had catastrophic incidences and that were not, in essence, that didn't take a major loss of life, but we had loss of life, 15 at one particular incident, and that was, of course, an accident that occurred, but it has great potential. And so my simple question is, do you concede the point that even if it is a question of how you assess the risk, that a small plane in the region that we're speaking of could cause major damage?
I think that is correct, yes.
And could cause loss of life?
That is correct.
And if it was not a accident, meaning some unfortunate pilot that lost their way, but in fact someone who intended to do so, the perimeter entry that you witnessed by video and the easy access to airplanes could contribute to that.
That is correct.
All right. I want to thank you for that. And let me just go to Dr. Galloway. I think, Dr. Galloway, that people are not understanding, I shouldn't say understanding, but capturing the essence of what you're saying, because I think it's major. You really focused us on the international general aviation. Many times those are large planes. And it could be that they could be carrying radioactive material, and they are unscreened overseas. Is that my understanding?
That's correct.
And so you have come here today, and I think, let me just read into the record again your testimony that says, we recommend exploring the option that all other U.S. entry screening and inspection activity, i.e. customs, agriculture, and health, be conducted concurrently for radioactive nuclear screening at the pre-clearance gateway. What you're saying is that you would like to have a scheme, a structure in place that would put in place the international general aviation structure that would screen for potential radioactive or nuclear material that is not at this point happening, and therefore making them a potential deadly target heading toward the United States, if that was their destination.
That's correct.
And did I understand you to say that you are working on such a structure, and funding would be the asset that you would need to carry through with this?
We're still in the planning phase for this. It's a sophisticated concept at this point, but there would be a lot of things to actually required to implement this. Funding would certainly be the backbone for it, but we would have to negotiate with our international partners. We would have to figure out, in fact, how to set up the gateway airports and the scanning processes, and then to operationalize all of them. So it would be a challenge, but a doable challenge. The other component of that problem would be to deal with the aircraft that come across on relatively short flights from Canada and Mexico, that we would set up airports along the U.S. border, but away from population centers, where they could land safely in the United States and then be scanned once they're on the ground. But the key to that is keep them away from population centers.
Do you think maybe we could work with this proposal and utilize pilot programs initially to see how this structure would work?
Yes. In fact, Customs and Border Protection has gateway airports in Aruba, Canada, and Bermuda, in which we're trying to negotiate the rights overseas with the foreign countries to allow us to do RADNIC screening. I think we're doing pretty well in those negotiations, and then we would implement them as pilot programs.
Well, I think most Americans would be grateful, Dr. Galloway, for your work, and I would think most Americans would not be aware of the potential threat of rad nuclear materials coming in on an international general aviation flight. Again, we are not attempting to create hysteria, but we are attempting to be good stewards of the American people and their needs of security. I would like to ensure that we have an opportunity to be briefed as you move forward, and particularly I would like to get a status report on the cooperative efforts that you're attempting with our neighbors. I'd also like to hear on the progress we're making with our extended neighbors, and that is our allies and friends and various countries that are, of course, in Europe and other parts of the world, because our general aviation flights come from all over the world, which leaves us vulnerable to any precipitous incident that might occur. So I'd appreciate that, and I'd appreciate us engaging on this concept of beginning with a pilot program, and as you've indicated, funding is not the only part of your need. We need to have an effective structure. I think it is both insightful and needed, and I will look forward to meeting with you as you make progress on this particular effort. I'd like to thank the witnesses and appreciate, again, very much your...
Madam Chair, could I say a word?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you come in. Let me yield for a moment to the gentlelady from the District of Columbia, which I've already gone on record saying that I support her proposition with respect to the District of Columbia and general aviation. The gentlelady from the District of Columbia, Mrs. Norton.
I appreciate your support, Madam Chair, and I appreciate, particularly appreciate this hearing, because it's given us a study in contrast without evidence. There's been an underlying risk consequences analysis. Everyone knew, particularly after 9/11, but they'd know in any case that New York was a particularly vulnerable jurisdiction to planes of every kind. Yes, even, of course, general aviation with its skyscrapers, with its enormous, indeed, its magnificently unique density. Indeed, the Department of Homeland Security knows it because it risks, it places New York City as the highest risk jurisdiction in the United States. And yet, the Homeland Security Department, it tells us, it ain't us, it's a Secret Service, approved within days of 9/11, general security aviation in the Big Apple. You know, they did a risk and consequences analysis of the kind they gave lip service to here when it came to Houston and to the District of Columbia. Now, as a result of this hearing, Madam Chair, I must say I believe that Houston is more vulnerable than the nation's capital. We don't have any manufacturing facilities, nuclear facilities, fuel storage facilities anywhere close to the nation's capital. There is plenty of perimeter control here in Houston. I saw no evidence either of perimeter control or of control by TSA in the air. And yet, if I'm a terrorist and all I've got is a small plane, I'm not likely to try the nation's capital. For one thing, we got the Air Force, as all of you know, who since 9/11 we have seen go in the air if they see anybody who even looks like they're penetrating the airspace of the nation's capital. False alarms, but all of us were put out in the streets several times. There's no question that the only place we are the only thing that you've not given sufficient attention to is commercial aviation in a country that prides itself on keeping commerce in place. Frankly, we've had to, in this city, Madam Chair, beat federal officials around the head and shoulders just to keep the city open until finally people understood that this is the United States. Is this America? We're capable of protecting our country. I want to say to all three of you gentlemen, it is a matter of some embarrassment to me that we've created a whole Department of Homeland Security and you all haven't figured out how to get ordinary commerce into the nation's capital. It's not only the nation's capital, it serves one of the real growth regions of the country. So it's a matter of embarrassment. It should be a matter of shame to you. Even without general aviation up in the air, you've had precautions here of the kind we don't have in New York and the kind we don't have in Houston. I think you've got to get your city straight. I think an appropriate risk analysis must be done here in the nation's capital. There are all kinds of layers. I didn't see any in that film, and I haven't heard you speak of any layers. So while I would agree with you that on any nationwide risk analysis, general aviation doesn't come up very high, but a particularized risk analysis needs to be done. It looks like you've done it only for the nation's capital. You got it all wrong. You've never been able to justify what you've done here. But I haven't seen comparable attention paid to jurisdictions near nuclear facilities, near fuel storage facilities. It does seem to me you've got some work to be done. By the way, I still think general aviation does not pose a major threat even to those jurisdiction, but this testimony today, Madam Chair, has convinced me that no risk analysis, major area of the country by major area of the country, has been done, and that they're dealing with nationwide assessment that I think you and I would agree with. I think we're entitled to more than that, given vast differences. Sometimes they don't have the same population, but terrorists are smart enough to know that we have guarded places like New York and D.C. And have a lot of chatter going on there. They may be smart enough to look for places where you could just do a big blowout and where maybe you want to take extra precautions there instead of spending all of your time looking at the navel of the nation's capital and stopping all general aviation for all intents and purposes here. Shame on you. That has simply got to be corrected. You've got to get all the players at the table and show that you know how to meet your dual responsibility to, in fact, keep this nation safe and to keep us economically and commercially strong at the same time. You've got two missions, not one. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Let me thank the gentlelady. I think, gentlemen, you have just recognized the great interests of this issue of general aviation, probably more so than you might have expected. I think we have had an opportunity to strike a balance in recognizing that general aviation is valuable, but it has its vulnerabilities, and maybe we now need to look across the nation, Mr. Salmon, as you look at your regulations, and of course the issue of the District of Columbia is more than you and a major policy decision which we as members of Congress will join with the Congresswoman. But as you look at this issue of general aviation and the regulations, I think there is a merit to looking at perimeter security, looking at where airports are located, and certainly you've already worked with the industry as relates to manifest, protection of vehicles, size of vehicles. We're making progress. But I want to be able to see a holistic approach to this issue. As I indicated, I want to thank Mr. Mann, Mr. Salmon, and Dr. Galloway. And there being no further questions for this first panel, I'd like to thank the witnesses for appearing before the subcommittee today. The members of the subcommittee may have additional questions for you. We ask that you respond to them expeditiously in writing. We now welcome our second panel to the witness table. Our first witness is Martha King. Since the early 1970s, Mrs. King and her husband, John, have been teaching pilots. Their company, King Schools, operates out of a dedicated complex in San Diego, California, that includes a television and software production facility. For more than 34 years, King Schools has delivered millions of videotapes, CD-ROMs, DVDs, and online courses to pilots and mechanics. Mrs. King is the first and only woman to hold every category and class of FAA rating on her pilot certificate, as well as every flight and ground instructor certificate offered by the FAA. Our second witness is Mr. Ollie Sluggers, who is the executive director of Centennial Airport in Denver, Colorado, one of the busiest general aviation airports in the United States and among the 30 busiest U.S. airports of any kind. Our third witness is Mr. Jeremy Rogalowski. He is an investigative reporter for KHOU-TV, the CBS affiliate in Houston. In February 2007, he aired a report exposing security lapses at three general aviation airports in the greater Houston area. Specifically, KHOU-TV acquired entry to those facilities, and in many cases, the aircraft doors were wide open and nobody questioned KHOU-TV's activities. This important reporting helped to galvanize a national conversation of general aviation security and was among the reasons for the IG report we discussed during our first panel. Our fourth witness is Mr. Mark Van Tine. Mr. Van Tine is the president and chief executive officer of Jeppesen. Jeppesen is a subsidiary of the Boeing Company. He has spent his career working in a variety of different areas within Jeppesen's businesses, including flight operations, customer service, charting, and information technology. Without objection, the witness's full statement shall be inserted in the record. I now ask each witness to summarize his or her statement for 5 minutes, beginning with Mrs. King. Mrs. King, you're recognized.
Chairwoman Jackson Lee, Ranking Member Dent, members of the subcommittee, good afternoon. It's a privilege to be here before you today. My name is Martha King. I'm co-owner of King Schools, a family-owned business located in San Diego, California. Our company produces DVD and web-based training courses for pilots. Nearly half the pilots in America who learned to fly in the last 30 years have taken one of our courses. In addition to being type-rated in our small company airplane, as Chairwoman Jackson Lee indicated, I also hold every category and class of FAA rating on my pilot and instructor certificates. My husband and I would not have been able to build our business without the use of a general aviation business aircraft. Our airplane is critical to the survival of our company and to the customers we serve. For example, King Schools provides the computer-based pilot training materials for some 300 flight schools throughout the U.S. that are Cessna pilot centers. These small, independent businesses are located on small airports at some distance from airports served by the airlines. We visit these flight schools regularly to give marketing and business development talks to their owners and employees. We bring along software engineers and technical support staff to solve our customers' computer issues. Because of our relationship with these Cessna pilot centers, we visit often with Cessna Aircraft Company in Wichita, Kansas. By using our company airplane, we can take 8 members of our small management team from San Diego to Wichita in the morning and return to San Diego that same night. The airplane helps us turn travel time into work time and limits our employees' time out of the office. This productivity just wouldn't be possible using the airlines. You don't often hear about companies like King Schools when you hear discussions about business aviation. But for every large company that operates a business airplane, there's 8 or 9 companies just like mine, small and medium-sized companies that provide jobs and bring commerce to communities across the United States. I want to thank you for having me here today as part of your hearing to discuss the Large Aircraft Security Proposal, or LASP, as put forward by the Transportation Security Administration. From an overall perspective, the proposal does not recognize the significant differences between commercial airline operations and non-commercial operations which do not carry members of the general public. The primary difference is that we general aviation operators know personally everyone on our aircraft. As a GA operator, I'm concerned about several provisions in the proposal, and I'd like to briefly mention three of them. The first concern is the prohibition of more than 80 items from being carried on board. This plan would dramatically restrict the productivity of many businesses. Some would not be able to carry their own necessary equipment or their own products. A second major concern is the proposal to establish a third-party compliance audit program. Some business airplane operators have told me this proposal would actually decrease security, since businesses would now be required to reveal internal security procedures to outside parties. I'm also concerned with the requirement to constantly vet our passengers against a no-fly list that at times has proven to be inaccurate or incomplete. We know our passengers. They are our employees and our customers. I believe that general aviation security would be best enhanced by the TSA establishing a rulemaking committee to address the questions and concerns raised by industry and the public on the LASP. This type of forum, often used by the FAA and other government agencies, has proven benefits. Since the events of 9/11, the general aviation community has been very proactive in developing and implementing a large number of workable and effective security measures. What general aviation operators seek and America needs are measures that do not represent a needless sacrifice in liberty without a benefit to society. The freedom of movement of private citizens has always been one of our great American ideals. We are confident that we can ensure security without sacrificing that ideal. Thank you, and I'm happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mrs. King. We appreciate your testimony. And now recognize Mr. Ole Slogers to summarize his statement for 5 minutes. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Ranking Member, and members of the committee. My name is Robert Oleslagers, and I'm the Executive Director at Centennial Airport, which is located in the metropolitan area of Denver. I wish to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you here today regarding the General Aviation Security Program, as well as the Large Aircraft Security Program. Before I begin my testimony, I would like to thank the committee and the committee members for your continued support on this issue. The provisions in H.R. 2200 could foster the kind of cooperative relationship that we're seeking with TSA. We also appreciate the security grant program as part of H.R. 2200. That's equally important and very much appreciated. I'd also like to thank Mr. Salmon for his personally leading the stakeholder meetings following the closure comment period of the NPRM. His open and pragmatic approach certainly was refreshing, and we hope that that will carry forward in the revised NPRM when issued. By way of background, I served on the working group of the Aviation Security Advisory Committee, which drafted the security guidelines for general aviation airports. I've also managed general aviation airports for the last 25 years, and at present I manage one of the busiest GA airports in the country. I also studied national and international security at the Air War College and at Harvard University. I believe that progress has been made with respect to general aviation airport security, including the recommendation that the TSA reconvene the working group to update the security guidelines for general aviation airports. And it appears that that suggestion is resonating with the TSA. That said, while the industry does not question the potential threats exist, I remain concerned with the overemphasis on the threat and the threat posed by general aviation aircraft. I'm also concerned about associated program costs, irrespective of the state of the current economy, as well as the erosion of civil liberties. Specifically, the NPRM's stated reason for the proposed rule contradicts TSA's own intelligence evaluation and conclusions. The TSA states that the reason for the NPRM is that the TSA is aware that as vulnerabilities within the air carrier and commercial industry are reduced, GA operations become more attractive targets. However, this is in direct contradiction with the assessment by the TSA Office of Intelligence, and the recent 2009 report by the IG makes the same finding. Another point I'd like to make is that the NPRM constitutes, in our opinion, an unfunded mandate pursuant to the Unfunded Mandate Act of 1995. Just at Centennial Airport alone, we estimate the law enforcement cost, nothing else, just the law enforcement cost, to run between $300,000 at the very low end up to $1.3 million per year. That would amount to, at current operating level, somewhere around $60 to $80 per landing or takeoff for each aircraft coming into Centennial Airport. It basically amounts to double taxation. The NPRM ignores privacy laws and private property rights. We are very concerned, and this is one of the more complex aspects of the NPRM, but it touches on both conflicts with other laws as well as federalism issues. I am not an attorney, however, extensive case law suggests that citizens enjoy extraordinary legal protections related to private property, privacy rights, as well as due process. And for this reason, we recommend that the privately owned aircraft be exempt and that the NPRM focus only on publicly operated aircraft for the most stringent initiatives. The NPRM also may inadvertently force some airports that are unable to comply with the NPRM as proposed to violate Federal Aviation Administration grant assurances and also be in non-compliance with federal commerce law relating to interstate access, possibly resulting in becoming ineligible for airport improvement program funding or becoming subject to other punitive actions. The NPRM also proposes an aircraft weight threshold not supported by the facts. The proposed weight threshold of 12,500 pounds is at least 50% below TSO's classified throw weight analysis and well below the industry recommended weight thresholds. Industry recommends that the threshold be at least 100,000 pounds or more. I can go into greater detail if you'd like. In conclusion, regarding the NPRM, we do not question that potential threats exist, but these must be weighed against mitigations already in place, including voluntary as well as mandatory, the threat to national security, and their likely probability. If the TSA is indeed serious about taking a more pragmatic approach to managing who flies the aircraft, who is on board the aircraft, and what is on board the aircraft, Administrator Salmon said, a more aircraft-centric approach, then the industry sees no need for costly airport security measures that do not demonstrably improve security. However, the effectiveness of a layered approach to security compels general aviation airports to play a value-added role in security. For this reason, we reiterate the recommendation that TSA reinstate the working group and update the security guidelines for general aviation airports in lieu of the airport security requirements proposed in the NPRM. This concludes my prepared remarks. Thank you very much for your time.
Ms. Olisvogers, we do thank you for your testimony, and I now recognize Mr. Rogalowski to summarize his statement for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, for the opportunity to discuss our investigative report, which aired in February 2007. KHOU-TV's initial approach was quite simple. Go to general aviation airports and see if you can get in, and if so, how far in could you get? As you've seen, the result was some GA airports were practically wide open to someone potentially stealing an executive-sized jet, taking off and turning it into a lethal weapon. Acting on a tip from inside the aviation industry, KHOU investigative photojournalist Keith Tomshi and I visited three GA airports in the Houston area, and using undercover cameras, we captured how easy it was to gain access into these facilities and to aircraft with doors left wide open. Aircraft, I should mention, with auxiliary power units plugged in, aircraft with unobstructed pathways to the tarmac and the runway. At one airport, we walked right through an unlocked door and walked right up to an unlocked executive jet. At another, we parked just yards away from a regional commercial jet and walked right up to it. No fences, no security, no questions. And at another, it had a security gate and call box, but both proved seemingly worthless on our visits, as evidenced by photojournalist Tom Shee's comments to gain access. Can you open her up for me? I'm here to see the plane. I was here last week. In both cases, the gate opened and we were next to a hangar and those aircraft with doors wide open. But KHOU-TV also uncovered the one thing that no one seemed to want to talk about in Houston, and that the DHS Office of Inspector General failed to address as well in its recent study, and that is our area is a target-rich environment that potentially makes us particularly vulnerable for a particular type of terrorism. Why crash a plane into a building when the Houston area, the Houston Ship Channel to be specific, is littered with million-gallon containers of toxic chemicals right next to a vulnerable population center? Containers that chemical plant engineers say could easily be ruptured by a small jet, a jet under 12,500 pounds. Containers that often are no more than a half inch thick. Containers that, in the words of one veteran chemical engineer, would, quote, tear like tinfoil from the kinetic energy alone, irrespective of fuel or weight-carrying capacity. In fact, we discovered deadly chlorine gas, a certain type of nerve gas, and many other dangerous chemicals stored all around Houston. And to quote a 2004 Homeland Security Council study, that study showed at least 17,000 people could die in such a strike from the ensuing toxic vapor cloud. Also, as we stated in our report, Mohammed Atta, the purported ringleader of the 9/11 hijackings, had been considering a similar sort of attack for years. We've attached a verbatim transcript of our original report as well as a follow-up report we did 3 weeks later in 2007. And in that, I should mention a corporate tenant at one of the airports we featured was quickly in the process of taking action, installing $100,000 in security upgrades, including a barbed wire chain link fence, cameras, infrared, and motion sensors. In that follow-up report, I should add, then DHS Secretary Michael Chertoff promised to, quote, turn up the temperature on the general aviation industry. Thank you for your time. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Rogalowski, thank you for your testimony. I now recognize Mr. Van Tine to summarize his statement for 5 minutes. Mr. Van Tine.
Thank you, Chairwoman Jackson Lee, Ms. Norton, distinguished members of the CIRC committee. My name is Mark Van Tine. I am President and CEO of Jeppesen and Chairman of the General Aviation Manufacturers Association for 2009. Jeppesen is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Boeing Company and is based in Inglewood, Colorado. For more than 75 years, my company has provided navigation charts, electronic databases, and other information services to general aviation and commercial airlines around the world. We serve more than 1 million pilots globally. I am also an active general aviation pilot. That said, I appear here today primarily in my capacity as the current chairman of GAMA. General aviation is an important contributor to the U.S. economy, supporting over 1.2 million jobs and providing more than $150 billion in economic activity annually. In 2008, general aviation generated over $5.9 billion in exports of domestically manufactured airplanes. We are one of the few manufacturing industries that still provides a significant trade surplus for the United States. Madam Chairwoman, I appreciate you for convening this hearing and to discuss general aviation security issues. GAMA has long been an advocate for general aviation security to be based on risk analysis, measuring threats, vulnerability, and consequences. When higher risks are identified, the appropriate countermeasures and security posture absolutely should be deployed in order to mitigate those risks. Since the events of 9/11, the general aviation community has worked diligently to increase security and raise the awareness of potential threats to the aviation system. A number of voluntary and regulatory initiatives have been put in place by both government and industry, which have substantially increased aviation security. I included a list of these numerous initiatives in my written testimony. These initiatives have been implemented to help prevent terrorists from using a general aviation airplane to attack the United States. It is in this light that we should review the development of the TSA's large aircraft security program. When TSA issued a notice of proposed rulemaking for last October, it generated a groundswell of negative reaction from the general aviation community, as well as from many members of Congress, because as it was written, it was unnecessarily burdensome, impractical, and did not reflect an adequate understanding of general aviation operations. I want to be very clear. The general aviation community does not impose enhancing security. Rather, it believes the NPRM, as proposed, needs to be reworked with adequate input from stakeholders. We want to help the TSA develop a program that mitigates legitimate security risks while facilitating general aviation pilots and passengers to exercise their freedom to fly. We have made good progress. During two industry working group sessions in April and May, we were able to agree with TSA on a framework for the last rule. Assistant Administrator John Salmon has committed to building upon what the TSA has learned from these two sessions and to issue a second MPRM. We commend the hard work that Mr. Salmon and the staff within the General Aviation Office has put into reworking the MPRM and their willingness to consider our views. We also appreciate the strong support we received from members of Congress who have recognized our concerns and urged TSA to develop a more practical and effective approach. In particular, I want to thank Congressman Dent and Congressman Olson for introducing H.R. 3093, the General Aviation Security Enhancement Act of 2009, which would ensure stakeholder participation in the development of LASP. Madam Chairman, the Chairwoman, I would like you to know that Gammon is very concerned about TSA's liberal use of security directives to implement new requirements on operators that are not subject to the rulemaking requirements of the Administrative Procedures Act. For instance, TSA has issued a security directive mandating an expansion of security credential requirements for tens of thousands of pilots, employees at airports, and aviation manufacturing facilities without prior input from these constituents or due process protection under APA. We recognize and we respect TSA's authority to issue security directives. However, we do not believe that TSA should use security directives to make policy unless there is a compelling and immediate national security risk that warrants it. In closing, Madam Chairwoman, I wish to thank you for providing me the opportunity to appear and testify today on these important issues. I must say I feel strongly that if TSA, industry, and the Congress continues to work together on general aviation security issues, we will put in place a security system that is safe and effective, yet does not inhibit the freedom people enjoy today to privately use general aviation aircraft. Thank you again for allowing me to be here, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Let me thank all of the witnesses for their testimony, and I'd like to remind each member that he or she will have 5 minutes to question the panel. And I now recognize myself for questions, and I would like to also add just an additional welcome to all of the members who have come have been very effective in contributing to our deliberations. I am hopeful that in your opportunity to listen to the earlier testimony, and as stakeholders, many of you, that you've had a positive response to this committee's personal or this committee's inquiry about March of 2009 to TSA to ensure that the industry would have ample opportunity to engage. So I do want to pose a general question to all of you, and I respect the different perspectives in which you have come, and that is to answer the question whether or not you think overall whether security has improved at general aviation airports. And again, some will be speculating or some will be based upon what you've heard. But I think the second question is even more important, and that is, do you feel that security regulations are necessary for general aviation? Let me start with Mrs. King.
Thank you, Chairwoman Jackson Lee. In my personal observation around the airport, I find very noticeable increases in general aviation security in awareness of all of the people at the local fixed base operators, the people that sell gas and provide services, and an awareness of who is around the airports checking out the cars as they are let through the gates. One of the things that some people may not be aware of is that many of the security procedures that are enacted are not obvious, deliberately so. because the point of having good security is that some of it is obvious to stop the casual person and some of it is less obvious. One of the points I would make is that in our own aircraft, when we go on a transient basis to another airport, the first thing we do after we land and the last thing is to disable the steering on the aircraft for security, and also it allows the operators there to tow the aircraft if they need to move it to allow for space. But the steering is disabled. It is not obvious that it is disabled, and the last thing we do before we leave is to enable it again. We may have the door open while we're loading luggage, but the airplane is still not stealable, if you will, because it's not steerable until we're back there permanently and ready to leave. So many of the security procedures that have been put in place are not obvious to someone who is not knowledgeable. And the security measures will vary depending on the model of the aircraft. That's just an example regarding our particular aircraft.
Sure. Same question. Just go right across and answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think general aviation security, the awareness since September 11th has been raised significantly. And as a result, I believe that general security at general aviation airports has increased. Should it be regulated, we believe that there is already a number of regulations in place, including 12-5 rule, large charters. So going beyond that, and with respect to the large aircraft security program, we believe that the industry has done an outstanding job regulating itself. I was part of the drafting of the guidelines for general aviation airport security, and we believe at this point that that is sufficient. We are asking the TSA that the working group is reconvened so that we can take another look at it. Thank you.
Mr. Roylasky.
Since our report aired, Madam Chair, we know two of the three airports we featured made voluntary security enhancements. As we mentioned, Lone Star Executive in Montgomery County, north of Houston. A corporate tenant there made $100,000 in security upgrades. I spoke with the airport director as of yesterday. He informs me that a interior security fence has been installed and a contract has been awarded to install a perimeter fence as well. That interior security fence has six locked gates. At Sugar Land Regional Airport, a spokesman there tells me 90% of their small planes have been moved into a fully fenced-in area with locked gates accessible by authorized key card holders. So in terms of the three airports we featured, we know two of the three have made those security upgrades. We have not received comment from the third airport, Hooks Airport.
We know that you're not an aviation expert, but would you then suggest that regulations with oversight would be a responsible act?
Respectfully, ma'am, as a news reporter, it's neither appropriate nor germane for me to offer an opinion. I can only report on the facts, shine a mirror up to those in the industry and those in your seats, and let you decide the appropriate course of action.
That's a fair enough response. We'll take from what you reported as an offering of what you perceive to be facts, and we will make our own decisions. Mr. Van Tine, your response.
Madam Chair, if you look at the response since 9/11 by organizations such as Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, the National Business Aircraft Association, GAMA, who I'm representing today, and the airport operators and all the general aviation organizations that that represent the industry, I think it's clear that security has improved as a result of these different programs that have been put in place and the actions that they take. Improving security will be a never-ending goal and activity in our industry, in our world, as we go forward, which is why we must work closely with FAA and TSA to look at those practical risks, and risk mitigation comes from very accurate risk assessments, and as an industry, we'll take action to close and mitigate those risks where they can. At the same time, it's easy to come up with a myriad of scenarios that make it very difficult for us to make it 100% safe. So As an industry and organizations industry, we're committed to work with the government to find ways to make it practical and yet allow the free commerce and use of aircraft the way that we have for almost 100 years.
I'll come back to you on my line of inquiry, Mr. Van Tine. I thank you for your answers, and I now recognize the ranking member, Mr. Dent, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ellislocker, Mr. Rogalski's investigative report pointed out that he and a colleague were able to gain access to an airport and that one had a substantial gap in the fence around the perimeter. You contend in your written statement that, quote, the industry sees no need for costly airport security measures that do not demonstrably improve security. Is it fair to say that you see airplanes as opposed to airports as the proper focus of additional security?
Thank you. The security of general aviation airports is layered. I prided myself when I first started to get into the flying business, and I was a little boy just being very interested in aircraft, being able to walk onto an airport. The thing that people decry today is that all these airports are now shut down, and they fathers can't take their kids out to airport, see the airplanes anymore. And I think that's a very sad state in the industry. And in fact, at Centennial Airport, which is one of the busiest general aviation airports in the United States, we continue to encourage folks to be able to get to their aircraft, and even visitors to be able to get to the aircraft. With respect to security of airplanes, there is a complex series of things that happen in order to perpetrate anything with an airplane. It's just not simply of being able to access an aircraft, but being able to access a hangar, maybe do something in that hangar. Most of our clients are known to our industry. We have lease agreements with them. We know who they are. They've been vetted properly. And so we feel that the current regulations are sufficient and that, in fact, as Mr. Salmon had suggested, there should be a more aircraft-centric approach to security rather than an airport-centric.
So you think it should be more aircraft as opposed to airport-centric?
Yes, sir.
And do you believe that fencing around an airport's entire perimeter will have any substantial effect on general aviation security?
No, sir. It's just like locks on doors. They're for honest people only.
So what do you say to Mr. Rogalski then and his report and his finding about the general aviation airport's vulnerabilities in the Houston area?
As reporters have come on board at Centennial Airport on the ramp, that's just one part. I don't believe that that's necessarily a breach of security, grabbing the airplane, loading it perhaps with explosives, turning it into an IED. A lot of other things have to happen. We take a layered approach to security. Simply getting on an airfield is very simple.
Thank you. And Mr. Van Tine, thank you too for being here. You mentioned that the expanding existing security requirements will involve implementation challenges, operational impacts, and economic burdens on the aviation industry. Could you please elaborate on that statement, and in particular, what are the nature, extent, and severity of the side effects to increased security requirements?
Well, again, we focus on the safe use of our aircraft, but the efficient use of those aircraft. So, for example, when we look at the DNPO requirements for and the suggestions they have for having gateway airports, which would require an additional stop for aircraft coming into the United States, takes away the utilitarian benefit of the airplane as a time machine and a time tool to support efficient use. And it would put airplanes into locations 100 nautical miles away from major metropolitan areas. Unfortunately, puts them into airports that don't have the facilities or the infrastructure to support these kind of aircraft. And so it's situations like that we're concerned about.
And will expanding existing security requirements exacerbate the already intense economic challenges businesses face every day, do you think?
It certainly will.
And finally, my time is, I have about a minute left. Ms. King, thank you too for being here as well. And I have to tell you, when this issue first hit, many pilots have contacted me, but none more forcefully than my neighbor. who actually at 11 o'clock at night came over and on the kitchen table laid it all out for me and said, my goodness, what are you doing? And what's happening here in Washington to our industry? And you got to make it very difficult for us to fly and for me to maintain my job in corporate aviation. And so he really made the point very, not very delicately, but he made it just the same. Could you please elaborate on and describe the differences between commercial and general aviation operations, why you think they're so different?
Well, in a commercial operation, you're basically taking an airline operation or even a charter for hire. You're basically taking anyone who walks up with money. You don't know them. You don't know who they really are necessarily. You don't know what they really want. In an operation like ours, we're a small company. We have about 50 employees. And what we carry, the people we carry on our airplane and what most general aviation business aircraft carry are their employees and their customers, all of whom have been known to them for a significant period of time. And we are, in my case, my husband and I are also the pilots. Pilots are already vested with great responsibility for the safety and the airworthiness of their aircraft, and also really for the security, because when we take any person onto our aircraft, we're not like someone standing at a metal detector in the terminal. When we make the decision that we're going to take that person on the aircraft, we're betting our lives on the fact that we know those people well enough that nothing's going to happen, that we know our employees, we know our customers. We're in the airplane all together.
You're not picking up any hitchhikers, I understand.
We're not picking up any hitchhikers.
I'm going to yield back my time and just thank all of you for being here, and just to say I felt very encouraged about Mr. Salmon's comments today and what he told me in my office the other day. I feel very encouraged, and I'm looking forward to something positive occurring on this issue. Thank you. I yield back.
Thank you very much. The chair will now recognize other members for questions they may wish to ask the witnesses. In accordance with our committee rules and practice, I'll recognize members who are present at the start of the hearing based on seniority on the subcommittee, alternating between majority and minority. Those members coming in later will be recognized in order of their arrival, and I'd like to have the clerk place this particular statement in the appropriate place under panel one. And I thank them. Before I yield to the distinguished gentlelady from California, from the Washington, D.C., I just want to make sure that Mr. Van Tine is aware of the legislation that I offer, transportation security legislation, H.R. 2200, that really laid the groundwork for improving stakeholder input into security policy decisions made by TSA. I think it's important to note that if we are to have the structure that you were speaking of, we really need to be careful about discussing security-sensitive information in a public rulemaking process, and we need to be careful in restricting the administration's ability to issue security directives that address an imminent threat. I think we struck the right kind of balance in H.R. 2200, but we did give you some additional rights, and I just wanted to make sure that was on the record. We'll have an opportunity to discuss it shortly, but let me yield to the gentlelady, Ms. Norton, for 5 minutes.
Yes, Madam Chair, your work and the work of this committee is why they're at the table at all. The chair has constantly discussed balance because I believe she, as well as I, have been on this committee since 9/11, and we lived through the worst of it. So the last thing we want to do is to throw out the baby with the bathwater. But the committee has been very, very critical of the subcommittee has been very and committee have been very, very critical of lack of balance and of failure to do. In fact, we had to over and over again compel Homeland Security to understand that risk and consequences and threat is what it's all about, as opposed to, you know, close joint town, meaning the United States of America. Ms. King, I want to congratulate you on your accomplishments as a pilot and the work of your company. I'm particularly interested in getting any real-time experience you may have. For example, have you flown into DCA or in general aviation aircraft into the nation's capital since 9/11?
Since 9/11, no, not in general aviation aircraft, because I'm not allowed to.
And why are you not allowed to, as one of the most experienced pilots in the country?
Because there are extremely difficult to meet rules about gateway airports and criminal background checks and air marshals on board the aircraft that frankly take the flexibility and the efficiency out of using a general aviation aircraft for transportation. We do still on occasion come to the DC area, but at this point our airports of choice are either Manassas or Frederick, Maryland.
So they have made it, even with the so-called open general aviation here, impossible. Economically impossible.
Economically impossible.
For you to come that.
Technically possible, but economically not.
Yes. And of course, notwithstanding your experience, the reduction in general aviation here means that you reflect what is happening throughout the industry. Could I ask all of you, thank you, Mr. Rogalski, for your work, but could I ask those in the industry to say to me, I know you're getting good cooperation. We heard from Mr. Sansom, and I want you to know you're getting that cooperation because this committee is insisted upon. This is not the goodness of their heart. So this committee needs to know, are the relevant representatives of helicopter, small aircraft companies, and pilots at the table as we speak?
So I'll answer the question from our perspective, and the answer is yes, they are there. And the fact that there were 7,000 responses and input back to the NPRM, and again, we appreciate Mr. Salmon and the work that TSA is doing to allow that process to happen, and we need to continue to do it. They are being represented and being heard now, and that's important. We still have a lot of work to do.
Mr. Al-Assad, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do agree with that. I've been able to represent a lot of the general aviation airports, in particular the reliever airports, on behalf of the American Association of Airport Executives, as well as airports and pilots in the state of Colorado. And we've seen great representation at all levels, as well as my own airport, where we have 700 based aircraft, again, from the very large aircraft to the very small aircraft. And
could I ask all of you, have you... So what about your ability to fly into other airports using general aviation aircraft? Are you able to fly? Ms. King indicated somewhere very close to the nation's capital. And do these other airports have gateway entrances with air marshals, fingerprints?
No, they do not. They make...
How about New York City?
We go into Teterboro. We have been into Newark. We go into MacArthur on Long Island. We go into White Plains. They, of course, have appropriate security on the airfield and at the operators that provide
service. But no gateway, no
gateway. No gateway, no air marshals, no criminal background check.
Right there in the Big Apple with all those skyscrapers, you're able to fly into... New York City.
Absolutely. They're very welcoming.
That's the experience, I take it, of all of you. The problem is one peculiar here, but you have been able at least to get in and out. I mean, get in and out of Houston. But it looks like nobody's watching where they should be. We learned that, of course, it's prohibitive to come into the nation's capital, even though the capital, if you add to the capital, the surrounding region, you have one of the engines of the American economy. What has been finally the impact nationally on the industry, whether you're looking at it from the pilot's point of view or from the point of view of the manufacturers? I'm trying to find out the industry, the result of these of the apparent until you all got at the table application across the board with very little distinction between commercial and general aviation. How's the industry preparing?
From a pilot training point of view, the regulations and particularly the prospect of more additional regulations that were considered when they were proposed to be very onerous with very little benefit has been very discouraging to people who might otherwise have been interested in taking up pilot training. So it's been very detrimental to the growth of the industry. It's been detrimental to the growth of the pilot population, and pilot training at the basic level is, of course, where eventually our airline pilots
come from. Okay, so nobody wants to be a pilot anymore because you can't get in the air. Mr. Alzager, you're the industry. Does anybody want to make these planes anymore?
Well, I'm actually part of the airport industry, and certainly for us, it's since 9/11, things have changed considerably because we do operate these airports. I can tell you, there's about 19,000 different landing facilities on the general aviation side of the house, and you've seen one airport. So it's been very difficult, having personally been involved with the working group writing the guidelines for general aviation security, to really get a template going that covers all of the airports. And I think the most important thing that we've been able to do working with AOPA and NBAA and other organizations is just raise the bar on awareness. And frankly, that's been the best security measure that we've been able to take. And that goes for Centennial Airport as well as some of the small grass fields. It's just be aware of your surroundings. And I think that goes for the same as walking in a parking lot these days or any other threat environment.
Finally, Mr. Bentine.
Well, these security programs have added overhead to the industry, clearly, and one that we've accepted. To your question about whether we want to build airplanes or not, we're also challenged by the economic times that are in front of us, and the optics that that have come from Washington and from other such areas as to the use of particularly business aircraft, and so and certainly the misunderstanding that. That those situations have created and how the airplane really is a general aviation airplane is an important tool to our economy, an important tool to commerce and to the businesses that use it. It's not just CEOs that use airplanes. In fact, some 85% of business aircraft operations do not contain in the back of the airplane a CEO or executive management, but are used for middle management, used for transportation of parts, materials, and for the conduct of commerce. So we're an industry that's entrenched in many different directions. This is one, but again, one that we recognize our obligation and need to support that continued enhancement in security in a practical way that works on both sides of this issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I thank the gentlelady for her instructive questioning. Now I'd like to recognize the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Olson, for 5 minutes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, and I appreciate the second panel, you guys sticking it out, learning a little bit about congressional procedure. I know it's been a long day for you, and thank you for giving us your time and expertise today. I want to briefly talk about, again, the Large Aircraft Security Program. Mr. Olislagers, and I apologize if I mispronounced that, and oh, right on. Okay, keep playing. But can you generally describe what we would have been required of you as the executive director of a general aviation airport, at least how the LSAP would have originally affected you as originally was proposed, and how some of the changes are going to affect you?
Thank you for your question. Prior to the NPRM being issued, we had a robust security program in place already. We have a lot of high income individuals at the airport who bring in their own security, and so we kind of follow that line. At the same time, we're also host to a lot of small aircraft, folks that come on the airfield with their grandkids and so on, want to have an open environment as well. So we tried to strike the balance as As Ms. Norton mentioned earlier, we've always tried to strike that balance. With the NPRM, our greatest cost, which actually the TSA completely omitted from its cost-benefit analysis, were the law enforcement officer requirements that this would have imposed on general aviation airports at Centennial Airport. We estimated at the very low end about $300,000, but at the normal operating level at the high end, $1.3 million in additional cost. That represents about 20% of my operating budget. Which is not very large. We run a fairly lean operation on a 24/7 basis. So that would have been a very significant hit to us. We had indicated, as many other airports did, when we did a poll through the American Association of Airport Executives, that all these other airports would, in fact, pass those costs on to the aircraft operators. In our case, anywhere between $60 to $80 per landing or takeoff. Very significant. There's a host of other issues that come with it, but that was certainly the most significant one.
And it sounds like you're happy then with the progress that's been made on the large aircraft security program.
Yes, sir. I've actually participated with two of the three stakeholder meetings that took place following the closure of the comment period, and Mr. Salmon has been very pragmatic in his approach, and we certainly look forward to seeing that reflected in the revised NPRM.
Thank you. Good to hear. Thank you. Mrs. King, same question for you, ma'am.
Most business aviation is in small companies like ours. We have about, as I say, about 50 people. And the economic impact of the original proposal would have been very significant in terms of not just directly, but considerable administrative obligations and reporting requirements. And all of this, we are a small, lean company. It is very important to us to be efficient in order to be competitive. And every administrative burden and impact that we have to bear significantly decreases our competitiveness and our ability to operate profitably. And the original proposal would have had a substantial economic impact on us.
If, don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're very happy with the progress that's been made since that original proposal.
I am personally not part of the stakeholders' meetings as an individual business owner. The organizations that we that I belong to, NBAA and AOPA and EAA, have been involved, and they are happy with the progress being made. And my feeling is that aviation security is very much like aviation safety. We do have in aviation the safest mode of transportation in the country, but that doesn't mean that we sit back and say that's enough, we've done all we need to. Industry has partnered with the FAA and others on the issue of aviation safety to continually keep increasing and enhancing safety, and that's what we look forward to doing with the TSA and with your committee and with the government to partner with you to continue to increase and enhance safety.
Thank you very much for that answer. That's a great point about how it relates to safety and how they're sort of analogous. I appreciate that. My final question is for you, Mr. Van Tine. I personally believe that flight and aviation is the perfect example of American innovation and ingenuity at its finest. And I enjoyed your written testimony, how you talk about the freedom to fly and how the laughs must not hinder the freedom. And if you're not familiar with my background, I was a pilot in the Navy for 10 years, had those wings of gold, flew P-3s, and that was the thing I enjoyed the most about it, was taking off, going up to 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 feet, looking down at the world, and looking at the ocean. I tried to fly a little bit after I got out of the Navy, flew a Cessna out of Winchester, Virginia here. But it became pretty obvious that the Navy, the costs were going to be a little different than when the Navy was supplying all the fuel I needed to go fly. But I just can't tell you how much I identify with that freedom to fly. And just can you explain how the last may be detrimental to that freedom?
Well, I think one of the examples we talked about that I heard in earlier testimony had to do with ranchers using aircraft to move materials and move workers, and this is in our commerce, but that and that the last rule, particularly as it talked about prohibited items list, which really was a carryover from the commercial side, would make it impossible for those folks to use that aircraft in rural areas. So general aviation supports, when you look at the 19,000 airports, landing strips, heliports around the country, many of those are located in rural areas or areas not served by commercial aviation. This is a vital asset to not just to our commerce, but for people being able to travel, to see family, to for recreation purposes, as well as for business. And so last, if you looked at the original submission by TSA, when you talk about the passenger watch list, people who get on our airplanes are known to us. If they're not known to us, we have systems now that, and working with TSA, I think we ought to find a way to make use of the e-secure system for the private sector so we can vet those that may not be known to us, but yet come to us recommended by a friend or by somebody that will be flying with. So this is an important part of our American heritage, certainly important part of our commerce. And so, again, practical rules that mitigate security risks but allow us to use these airplanes as we have had for many, many decades is important to us. And we are making progress with TSA. Certainly, there's still many things to do, though.
It's good to hear. Again, we can't ever lose the freedom to fly, in my personal opinion. I don't want to thank all the witnesses for your time, your patience, and your expertise today. Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. I yield back the rest of my time.
I look forward to us utilizing what I think has been very important. And before I conclude this hearing, Mr. Olson, you were able to fly, and the rest of us want to fly. So we are grateful for your comments about the freedom of flying. It is something I think we all agree with as Americans. This hearing is to promote safe and secure general aviation. You've heard from both sides of the aisle a commitment to general aviation, and in fact, you've heard a rather vigorous statement by the general lady from the District of Columbia wanting to ensure that general aviation can come to Washington, D.C. I do think it's important, as I ask these few questions of clarification, that we try to assess, again, the line of questioning of Mr. Olson, and I'd like to hear it from the three industry representatives, just again, because we are moving forward, and I hope that you will affirm that because of this committee's work, that we got the attention of TSA. And you were in very important industry meetings. So I know, Mrs. King, that you were not in the meetings, but do you feel that we don't have the next step of the written regulations, but have you gotten word back that TSA's new procedures with the stakeholders' input was a better procedure, was a better opportunity?
We participated in the TSA's general public meeting hearings in Burbank, California, and also sent, ours was one of the 7,000 comments that went in regarding the original NPRM. And we are very encouraged by the fact that the TSA is rewriting or reworking, I'm not quite sure the procedure that they follow, notice, and the information that we are hearing through the associations that we belong to does indicate that they are paying attention to the stakeholders and recognizing that that what they had done in the previous proposal was a cookie cutter, copy all of the commercial airline rules over, and that they recognize that that is inappropriate. There are, of course, still issues to be worked out, but I understand that there are significant discussions underway, and that's the extent of my knowledge.
You feel better about the process?
I do.
Ms. Olesflager, would you comment on this whole idea of your thought about vulnerabilities that need to be addressed? We'd be interested in your perception of whether or not we can do that together.
Certainly. First of all, I'd like to thank this committee for continuing to raise the issue, because I think without it, the TSA may not have come to the table necessarily to provide the perspective and some of the sit-downs that we've had with the TSA. So I want to thank you for your leadership and the committee and the members. With respect to vulnerability assessments, TSA to date has not done any vulnerability assessments that I know of within the general aviation industry. Obviously, we have done our own vulnerability assessment at Centennial Airport. We had the National Guard in, also private sector. We did red team exercises. I think they're very important to understand for any infrastructure environment, any critical asset, that should be done. My own assessment of the general aviation industry is such that we believe that there's a lot of other threats elsewhere that are far greater than a general aviation industry, and I hope that those will get addressed as well. We're doing our part at Centennial Airport, and on behalf of the American Association of Airport Executives, I'm assisting certainly my colleagues who are all grappling with this issue, but again, we appreciate all of your time in this as well. Thank you.
Mr. Vantine, thank you. Mr. Vantine and Ms. King, I'd like to ask this question. How much do you think general aviation can invest in security measures?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, because it depends on what those security measures need to be, which is, again, why we feel it is important we team with TSA and really understand those risk assessments and then what are mitigating actions that result from that. So it is an industry that, that is highly regulated and it's expensive. And so, clearly in this kind of economic environment, our tolerances are low, as are other industries. But at the same time, this is an essential issue, and we're going to do our part to find the right way the right balance between that security and the ability for the industry to operate.
I think that is a cooperative expression of being willing to work with us on security and safety. In this instance, this is about security. Ms. King?
Obviously, security is important to everyone in general aviation, because it's part of our whole safety orientation. And as pilots and general aviation operators, we're trained from the time we first start flying to focus on risk management and risk assessment and mitigating risk. The economic impact of the additional security measures, and again, as Mr. Vantine remarks, it depends on what those measures are, may be disproportionate depending on the size of the company. For a company our size or smaller, it could be, depending again on what security measures we're talking about, it could be a crushing economic impact issue that makes you reconsider how whether you can afford to use a company airplane. And that would be, in my opinion, a tragedy, because it would mean a considerable decrease in efficiency and competitiveness.
And I appreciate that. I want to leave this hearing so that we have the parameters that we can work with TSA and this committee. So, Mr. Oleslager, let me just suggest that there are all levels of suggested security procedures or implementation. Say, for example, an airport, a small airport, was asked to have signs, was asked to document their security procedures, have some sort of report, positive passenger cargo baggage, four passengers, four bags, or however many, the aircraft secured at night or in the daytime, community watch program, and the contact list. And the contact list would be, who do we reach in times of trouble? Is that onerous?
Madam Chair, that is not onerous. Those are all good business practices. Those are part of the best practices during the Last summer, we hosted the Democratic National Convention. We also ramped up during that special event our security protocols. We stand down when we believe there are no specific threats. So we take a layered approach to security, and all of the aforementioned items that you brought up certainly are part and parcel of a good best practices program.
And can those of you who deal with airlines, airports and airplanes, tell me the size plane by pounds, and I use tonnage at another point, but I'll use pounds, 12,000 to what, Ms. King, have you been engaged in or utilized in terms of aircraft?
The airplane that we currently own weighs approximately 18,000 pounds.
18,000. Thank you. Oleslager.
The aircraft, we can effectively handle up to 100,000 pounds, although we've had Boeing 737s up to about 160,000 pounds, so we can handle those airplanes.
So, and you go down, what's the smallest?
Probably J3 Cub, a slow Piper Cub, fabric wings, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Probably less than 5,000.
Less than 5,000. Mr. Van Tine.
And personally, I'm flying aircraft that are 3 to 4,000 pounds in size, so it's very small. Although, again, in my company works with 650 airlines and all segments of general aviation around the world. So my exposure comes from working with customers, but personally operating small, very small light aircraft.
Thank you. Mr. Rogers-Foxley, when you did this report, did you visit with or look at video or work that other reporters had done on this same topic?
No, we didn't, Madam Chair.
And do you have any knowledge about whether or not any other incidents has occurred in terms of just other locations? Did you, if you didn't consult with them, do you know of any tapes or any other reports like this, not in Houston but around?
From a news perspective, one would think that would have been the objective of the Inspector General report. But when you make announced visits, as we sought comment from aviation security experts regarding that report, one of the takeaways that they got was that the OIG visits to these airports were announced. The proper analogy, according to this expert, was if you're a restaurant owner and the health department is going to do a health inspection and they call you ahead of time, by golly, you're going to have your kitchen spotless clean. Whether or not that holds true is, again, not my place to make a judgment, but no, I don't know of any other incidents. But then again, I think it's evidence from the OIG report that there was no attempt to gain entry unannounced, unplanned, to see if there was a larger issue, ma'am.
I can tell you that my staff did find other media outlets who had come across some of the same circumstances, and I would not expect if you did not, were not made aware of them, but they existed, and that was my question to the IG. Now, you raise a very good point, the announcement, but more importantly, did they take the single question that happened to come from a single market trying to make a broader, express a broader concern, that they thoroughly look in a more broader fashion so that we could help all? This was not a Houston story. This was, in fact, a effort to secure America better. That's what I took from the reporting that you were able to do. Let me compliment by way of, as I conclude, so that you can understand the thrust of our efforts, and you can view this as a compliment, even though it is a stark set of circumstances. Ms. King, I think teachers, pilots, or is it only that you have a craft that people are able to secure? Do you do training, pilot training?
We do. What we do is training pilots for the knowledge component. We don't actually teach in the aircraft.
Okay. But we all are aware, certainly, of the facts of 9/11 as relates to general aviation. We know that the terrorists found a general aviation facility. And we know that they were being trained in all innocence. We understand that their source of exchange was U.S. cash. And we also documented that they were trained in their rush to take off. And it appears that they really were not interested in getting any training to land. And there may have been differing levels of how they handled that, but we know that happened. So my question or my comment is, look how far we've come. Ms. Van Tine, do you think anyone is now, we hope, at least monitoring how they take cash? Would you say that is occurring? Would you say that General Aviation is very suspicious of anyone who wants a hybrid training takeoff and have no way of getting down?
Absolutely.
Would you also surmise that there is a little bit more documentation on students that are coming into, you would suspect, any training facility to be trained?
Not just a little bit, but quite a bit.
And I make the point because although that was a set of circumstances that none of us could have ever imagined, look how far you've come. You've made very reasonable and rational decisions that really are about security. And we applaud you for that. But we live in remorse, obviously, of that whole tragedy, which had many different factors that contributed to it. That is why we're here today, to ensure that we take the next leap, having the industry as stakeholders, recognizing it's a vibrant and thriving industry, and as well, recognizing that the media, reporters, help us in an instructive manner so that we have the documentation, the actual documentation, that can help us do better. That's what this hearing was about today. So I simply wanted to make that point. Mr. Van Tine has answered for all of you, but if Ms. King, if you want to say that you believe you've made strides, I know you were in business in 9/11, were you not?
Yes, and flight instructors throughout the country are taking security training and recurrent training on a regular basis. And the points that you've talked about, Madam Chair, about taking cash and students who want unusual kinds of training are those and other points are a very heavy focus of that training. So there is a very, very heightened awareness.
I thank you, Mr. Oleslager. Do you want to comment?
Very briefly, I think since 9/11, just as passengers on a commercial flight will no longer accept an hijacker's thought that they don't, you know, that they will still survive the end of the flight, we've seen changes in general aviation and you know, become smarter. And I think that awareness issue needs to continue to take place. As I've said before, you know, over-regulation is probably not the answer. We have a security program at Centennial Airport that is probably the simplest security program we have. We reward people who see anything that happens on the airport that's unusual. It's very successful. No high-tech cameras can do a better job than us being aware, and that's really, I think, the focus that we certainly from our general aviation would like to continue to pursue. And less regulation and more awareness.
Well, I thank you for that final word. I will just add back that it will be regulation with balance, and I think that will be a fair approach to how we move on general aviation. Allow me to thank all of the witnesses who have now appeared. And I want to make mention of the fact that I also thank the members for their valuable questions and acknowledge the constructive manner in which the witnesses answer the questions. The members of the subcommittee may have additional questions for the witnesses, and we ask that you respond to them expeditiously in writing. Hearing no further business, the subcommittee